Hello and welcome to Our Science, the podcast with all the latest news from around the Royal Society. I'm Eleanor Beale.
And I'm Camilla Tam.
In this episode, we'll be focusing on women in science. We'll be hearing from fascinating scientists who are working on mathematics education and the teenage brain, as well as looking at efforts to improve diversity in science.
We'll also be talking about books in this episode, as the Royal Society Winton Prize for Science books and the Young People's Book Prize winners were both chosen in November, so stay tuned for lots of interesting interviews.
First up, we have Professor Margaret Brown from King's College London, who was recently awarded the Cavley Education Medal. This medal is awarded biennially to an individual who's made a significant impact on science or mathematics education in the UK. On receiving the medal, Professor Brown, a mathematics education researcher, gave a lecture at the Royal Society, and afterwards she talked to us about education research and how it can help us to make evidence-based policy.
What are your current areas of research in maths education?
Well, I've just finished a project with Jeremy Hodgson, which was really about improving secondary students' understanding of algebra and of multiplicative thinking. Multiplicative thinking covers things like ratio and also fractions, decimals and so on, all the sort of things that you need to do to be able to solve ratio problems. The first thing we did as part of that research was to try and work out on a sort of national sample what children already understood. And as it happened, we also had the results from the 1970s, so it gave us an interesting comparison back over time. But what we were really using it for was to design some teaching materials. So we worked with a group of teachers trying to design teaching materials which children would find challenging and interesting and which would really develop their thinking at a deep level rather than just having to learn lots of formulae. As a result of that, we did find that we managed to about double their rate of learning, but it was only on 10 schools. So we've now got to try and find out whether we can roll that out more widely to a much bigger group of schools.
You've also been involved in education policy throughout your career, and there's been a lot of talk recently about using evidence in policy making. What do you think should and can be the contribution of education research to education policy?
I think we don't have full research evidence about everything that happens in schools by any means, but gradually over time, I mean, maths education research really only started seriously in about the 1960s, and gradually over time we're slowly amassing results, which means that there are some things that we can actually be quite sure about. We find that some patterns of development happen in different places, so there seems to be some underlying results there about how children learn. We also find that particular ways of teaching tend to be more effective than others. So we are gradually and very slowly, in comparison to the sciences, amassing a kind of database which will inform policy. But I think it's important for researchers to be one step ahead of policymakers, to try and guess what is going to be the evidence that will be needed when they're thinking about how to solve a problem. So the real question is to get out there and research the significant problems that we think are going to come up in about 5 years' time. That's quite hard to guess sometimes.
What do you think are the key maths education issues at the moment?
I think one of the real problems is that the national the government and the sort of national initiative is all about trying to improve our results in line with the high attaining countries, in struggling to do that, we're sometimes copying their curriculum, copying their teaching methods, and that may not be right for our children and our teachers. So I think it would be better, really, if we tried to take our eyes off what other people are doing and say, here we are in this century, in this country, at this time, what is the best thing for our own children and our own teachers to be doing, which will both make them feel positive about maths, want to go on learning it and learn it successfully, and in turn raise standards as well.
We're going from one Royal Society prize winner to another now.
Yes, the Royal Society's Rosalind Franklin Award is given annually to a woman who has made an outstanding contribution to any area of science, technology, engineering or mathematics. This year's winner, Sarah Jane Blakemore, gave her prize lecture to the public here earlier this month. Eleanor caught up with her before the lecture to ask her what she'd be talking about and to find out what she plans to do with her award to promote women in science.
I'm Sarah Jane Blakemore. I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience at UCL. In my lab, we're really interested in how the adolescent brain develops, both in terms of brain structure and brain activity and behaviour. And we're particularly interested in how the social brain develops, that is, the network of brain regions that we use to understand and interact with other people. So what I'm going to be talking about is our research and research from other labs around the world that have shown that the human adolescent brain undergoes really very significant change across the teenage years and right into the 20s. And I'm going to be particularly focusing on the changes in the social brain areas.
And these changes that you talk about that are happening in adolescence, is this new information? Did we think that nothing was happening during adolescence before?
If you asked neuroscientists about 15 years ago, when does the human brain stop developing? They would have only really been able to guess, because until about 15 years ago, we just didn't have the ability to look inside the living human brain and to track changes in brain structure and function across the lifespan. Until about 15 years ago, we really relied on animal research and human post-mortem research, which was very scarce. And I bet you probably most neuroscientists would have said, oh, sometime in sort of early or mid-childhood, most brain development will be over. We now know that's absolutely not the case. And in fact, the human brain continues to develop for several decades.
A lot of this progress has been led by technological development. So can you say a bit about that contribution?
So the main technological development that has enabled us to look inside the living human brain is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. This is a type of brain scanner that allows us to look inside the living human brain and take photographs of the structure of the human brain and track how the structure changes across the lifespan, and also allows us to take films of the living human brain as it's working. So you can put people in a scanner, get them to do tasks like look at faces or read words or hear sounds, and we can see where the brain is active, and we can see how that activity changes across the lifespan.
And do you expect that future developments in your field are going to be led by technological developments?
Definitely. The technology has revolutionised what we know about the developing human brain. However, there's still a lot we don't know. And that's because the technology just isn't there yet. For example, we know about broad structural changes at a kind of crude level. We don't know what they correspond to at a cellular or synaptic level. That's the next question, and that can only be solved with technological advances. I don't know if they're going to happen in my lifetime. I hope so.
So are there implications from your findings for things like education or medicine for teenagers?
Well, I think the knowledge that the teenage brain undergoes very significant development firstly tells us that, you know, this is a period of life where the brain is changing naturally and very significantly, and that it's probably a very good opportunity for things like learning and creativity and plasticity. It also might tell us about which skills are particularly amenable to learning and training during the adolescent years. We know that some regions of the brain develop quicker than others, and that might have an implication for when to teach what. I think generally understanding the changes that are going on in the adolescent brain is helpful for parents and teachers, because prior to knowing about the changes that happen in the adolescent brain, adolescent typical behaviour, so things like risk-taking and peer influence and self-consciousness, was put down almost entirely to hormones. But we now try to understand that kind of adolescent typical behaviour, in addition to hormonal changes, also to changes that are happening in the cortex.
Is there an interaction between those structural changes and the hormones that are in the body in that time, or are the structural changes sort of predetermined before that?
That's a brilliant question. Yeah, so the question is, you know, if you think about early adolescence, there's not a tight correlation, there's not a tight relationship between age and maturity, puberty status. You can have a group of 12-year-old girls in all different stages of puberty, some pre-puberty, some late puberty. That's completely normal, that variation. The question is, what will the brain track? Do brain changes track changes in age, chronological age, how long you've been alive, or do brain changes track changes in hormone levels? And actually, that's a really open question. This kind of question is only just starting to be asked in cognitive neuroscience, but we have evidence that actually both matter. Depends on the brain region you're talking about. Some brain regions seem to be driven more by hormone changes, by physical maturity. Other brain regions seem to be driven by how long you've been alive, chronological age, independent of how physically mature you are.
The Rosalind Franklin Award provides funds for you to implement a project to raise the profile of women in STEM subjects at your host institution or within your field in the UK. So do you have any plans?
So I work with teenagers a lot. I go into schools, give talks. I work with them as part of our research. And one thing that always surprises me is that the stereotype that scientists are men still very much prevails in schools, despite the fact that actually these days lots of scientists are women. So my project aims to raise the profile of women scientists. So one of the reasons why I think the stereotype prevails is because there are not very many female, very high profile female scientist role models. If you look at images of scientists, they're often men. So if you put into Wikipedia scientist, you have a lovely montage, beautiful montage that is so undiverse, it's kind of laughable, looks like a parody. So it's not really surprising that the stereotype that, you know, scientists are men still exists. So my project is to create a blog that that interviews scientists about their lives and how they got into science. And this blog will be aimed at teenagers in secondary schools. It will be partly created by teenagers in secondary schools. I'm going to ask them to help me come up with questions that they are particularly interested in answering, and they're going to help me do things like work on the layout of the blog and the title for the blog, and I will interview both women and men scientists in equal number. So hopefully it will increase the representation and the diversity that of scientists that teenagers are being exposed to.
Are there any other things that you think should be happening to sort of improve that diversity in science?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very big question. And I think one thing that can't be underestimated is role models and visibility of women scientists. So I think it would be very, very good thing for the representation of women in science to increase the number of women scientists on television, for example, or in the media, or doing kind of social media talks, that kind of thing. That is one way of increasing the visibility of female scientists and making them more high profile to young people who are choosing what careers to do.
You can watch Professor Blakemore's lecture in full on the Royal Society website. Her project sounds great, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. In fact, she mentioned there the images of scientists that pop up on Wikipedia, and that leads us neatly onto another small project that's been helping to improve the visibility of women in science.
Ada Lovelace Day in October is the time to celebrate the achievements of women in science, technology, engineering and mathematics. So, here at the Royal Society, we joined forces with the Medical Research Council and Wikimedia UK to hold a Wikipedia Editathon.
At the event, a group of volunteers were trained to create and update the Wikipedia pages of women scientists. We interviewed two of the volunteers, Abby Schlageter and Dr. Holly Hedgeland, to find out what they had been doing during the day and why they had decided to get involved.
Is this your first time getting involved in an event like this Wikipedia Editathon?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very excited to see that you guys were focusing on women in science and really kind of rewriting history, or rewriting even current information about scientists, because it really is male dominated, and I don't think that necessarily reflects reality.
Have you been researching somebody in particular today, or what have you been doing?
Yeah, so I just did a an article about Professor Nicola Clayton. She seems to be looking, I don't know her personally, but it's very interesting. She's the scientific advisor for the Rambert Dance Company. So she's been quite involved in some dance performances, which is cool. And then also I was doing a Wikipedia article about my professor, who taught me in physics for 3 years, and she was just elected as a fellow of the Royal Society this year. So it's very exciting to be adding to her article as well.
Do you think you'll be taking forward some of the skills you've acquired today? Do you think you'll continue kind of looking for activities like that?
Definitely. I would really love to, well, I know you guys have an archive here which is available online, and I'd particularly like to look into some more of the history and kind of rewrite historical or update historical records on women in science. It's something I don't know that much about, and I didn't really know how to go about doing it. But now I have access to those documents, and also on the welcome library. We were shown a lot of documents. Like, we got to see, you can see Rosalind Franklin's original lab notes about when she was finding out about the DNA helix. So cool. So I would really like to add to Wikipedia in that way.
I thought it'd be a great thing to do because there are a lot of female scientists who just haven't got a very high profile. So the piece that I'm editing this afternoon is for one of the new FRS female scientists for this year. It's fantastic to see a few more women out there. I'm really, really keen to do that because I've noticed in the time that I've been teaching that my girls seem to find it quite difficult to be inspired still to follow a path into science and maths.
Great. And so you said you were a teacher before. So did you use Wikipedia in your teaching?
Yes, I must admit I do use Wikipedia in my teaching. It can be a really useful resource for children for checking up on things. And I certainly would encourage them to go and have a look at something they're not sure about. And it's, you know, people say, well, Wikipedia might not be accurate, but most of the articles at that kind of level were perfectly good for the kids to have a look to help them with the homework.
Good. And is it the first time you've been involved in such an event?
It is, yes. So it's really exciting to learn a bit more about how to make those edits and to actually see that that's kind of within reach, that you can really contribute after just, you know, sort of not even an hour of sitting there practicing, that you can really get something out there that looks as if you've been doing it for years and make that excellent contribution.
Hopefully you can find out much more about women scientists on Wikipedia now. Maybe you can start by looking up Ada Lovelace herself.
Good idea. Our final segment on women in science comes from a recent History of Science lecture where Dr. Claire Jones, writer, lecturer, and researcher of gender history at the University of Liverpool, discussed a more historical perspective. We've edited together a few highlights here.
Sisters in Science, I'm going to talk about Hertha Ayrton, women, and the Royal Society in the context of the years around 1900. In 1906, the physicist and electrical engineer Hertha Ayrton was awarded the Royal Society's Hughes Medal for original discovery. The president of the society, astronomer William Huggins, was appalled, quite frankly. In a bad-tempered letter to his secretary on the council, he wrote that the news would cause great joy and rejoicing in Her Majesty's jail among the women in prison, and of course he meant the suffragettes who were in Holloway at the time, and that the women of Girton and Newnham, the colleges for women at Cambridge, would get up a night of orgies in honour of the event. The letter goes on to say that he would have blocked the award of the prize to Hertha had he not been absent from the council meeting due to a cold. Now, William Huggins, astronomer, despite having a very able scientific wife, was one of the old school at the Royal Society Council who feared that women scientists, of whom there are increasing numbers in the decades around 1900, feared that if they were admitted as fellows, they might trivialise and lower the status of the Royal Society. And of course, it was to be, as I'm sure you all know, some 50 years later when the first women fellows were actually elected, Kathleen Lonsdale and Marjorie Stevenson. Despite the comments of William Huggins, the history of the Royal Society is not solely or even nearly some kind of story of blinkered misogyny towards women. Women have participated at the periphery from at least the early 19th century and a bit before. It was no surprise that women were beginning to make their way in science in more numbers by around 1900. The universities began opening their doors to women at the end of the 19th century. So women were beginning to access the scientific education almost similar to that available to their brothers. Although the growth of higher education was a turning point for scientific women, we mustn't get carried away. There was much resistance to women accessing laboratories for research. There wasn't such an issue if they accessed it just for educational purposes. Anyway, Hertha is perhaps most known for being the first woman to be nominated for a Royal Society Fellowship in 1902, and of course for receiving the Hughes Medal for original discovery in 1906. Now, Hertha's first major researches were on the electric arc, and she took these over from her husband. Now, they were carried out in her husband's laboratories at the Central Institution, which later became part of Imperial College. And it's interesting that Hertha, because she was the wife of the professor, could go in and use the laboratory and use his students to help her and her sister in her researches, and that was no problem. And this is the first research, her researches into the electric art, that she demonstrated at her first Royal Society Conversazione in June 1899. The Daily News reported on this event in quite wonder that a woman was actually demonstrating. Now, when Hertha was nominated to a fellowship by a handful of Royal Society fellows, including her husband in 1902, it presented the council with a dilemma that really touched on not just the society's relationship to women, but the whole place of the society in relationship to the other societies. So Hertha's nomination was intimately connected with wider and personal animosities within the society. And I say, there's no doubt that the modernisers saw the issue of the admission of women as fellows as part of their battle to modernise. Now, the sensitivity of the Royal Society to the question of women fellows is evidenced by the letter that the council sent to every single fellow when it considered Hertha as a nomination. Now, they explained that they consulted legal opinion. In fact, they consulted two lots of legal opinion. And they explained that this opinion said that they couldn't consider Hertha because she was married and her person there was therefore covered in the person of her husband. Therefore, it wasn't their fault. Not guilty, Gov. Hands are tied. We can't even consider her. In that way, they kind of ducked making a decision and tried to duck controversy and relieve themselves of any blame. Maybe it was the only thing they could do. It was a very divisive vote. The dispute between the factions and the Royal Society continued, however, and was exacerbated when Hertha was nominated for a medal. Later on in the same letter that I quoted right at the beginning of this talk, Huggins writes in dismay, "Can we now refuse the fellowship to a medalist?" He was really unsure. But as we know, of course, it wasn't until 1945 till women were actually admitted. The Royal Society may not have admitted women as fellows, but it did support them in other ways. And I really don't want to look at the history. It's far too simplistic to just see it as a history of misogyny and anti-woman. It's of its time, and women were at the periphery, but the fellowship was something different. We need to widen where we look to find women scientists. We need to look in the domestic sphere, not just at lists of women who won prizes or membership of societies, etc. They access science through men, typically husbands, so we need to look perhaps at men's papers to find evidence of their work. They were categorised as assistants because of their sex, but we need to look at this and check that that is the case, or is it not the case? We need to widen what we understand of as science. I said a lot of women worked in science popularisation or translation, but that was where they found a niche in science. Given the persistence of low participation by women in science and an absence of role models, as well as science's colouring perhaps still as masculine, I think it's important that we remember them.
You can also listen to that lecture in full on our website. To end this episode, we're focusing on our two book prizes.
On the 25th of November, we celebrated the shortlist of the 2013 Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books. Comedian and science enthusiast Dara O'Brien hosted this fascinating evening in which each of the shortlisted authors gave a reading from their book and discussed their thoughts and motivations with Dara and the audience. After a few brief words from David Harding, chair of the sponsor of the prize, Winton Capital Management, Sir Paul Nurse announced the winner of this year's prize to a packed-out room, The Particle at the End of the Universe by Sean Carroll.
Sean is a practicing theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, as well as an author. And here he talks to us about why he wrote the book, the difficulties involved in writing about the Higgs boson, and the important messages that he wanted to communicate.
This is really a historic time in particle physics. We have the Large Hadron Collider, a giant particle accelerator outside Geneva, Switzerland, which is looking at higher energies than we've ever looked at before. And that's where you discover new things. So we actually knew, or at least hoped, or at least expected, that we were going to find the Higgs boson in 2012. And early in the year, we had already had a little bit of hint. It was ready to say, okay, this is probably going to happen. We should really explain it to the wider world as best we can. And as important as the Higgs boson is, it is not easy to explain. So I thought this was just the perfect opportunity to both explain some really deep and fascinating physics, but also tell a little bit about the human side of it. The fact that, you know, there are thousands of physicists who've devoted their lives for this quest that take many years to fulfill. There's no question that particle physics can be difficult sometimes. The concepts we run into are not familiar to most people in their everyday lives, and that should be no surprise. The world of our everyday lives is very, very far removed from the world of particle physics. I think that enough people have heard about the Higgs boson to have heard the idea that it has something to do with mass. And the relationship is a little bit fuzzy in many people's minds. We're told that the Higgs boson gives other particles mass. So the main question I get is, what does that really mean? How does that work? Could we go on a diet by changing the Higgs boson content in our body or something like that? And admittedly, it's a subtle kind of story. What the Higgs boson does is it gives mass to elementary particles, like the electron, like the quarks that make up the protons and neutrons in your body. But those quarks, when they get into protons and neutrons, most of the mass in your body isn't from the Higgs boson. It's from the protons and neutrons, which get a lot of their mass from the interactions between the quarks inside. So without the Higgs boson, there will be a very different place. There'd be no electrons be moving at the speed of light and so forth. It is absolutely crucially important. And it gives mass to the elementary particles, but it doesn't really give mass to you. Your mass comes from somewhere else. I thought it was important that because the topic of the Higgs boson does seem a little esoteric, does seem a little bit removed from our everyday concerns, I felt it was really important to make it clear that science is a human endeavor. These are real people who are devoting their blood, sweat, and tears to answering these deep questions about the nature of the universe. And when it comes to a search like this, it requires more than just a few lone geniuses or even a few people in their laboratories in their basements. You need thousands of people. You need billions of dollars. You need many, many countries to come together over years of effort. And the human race achieved that. That's why the Large Hadron Collider is such an amazing story. It's a story of dedication and cooperation in the pursuit of a goal which is resolutely impractical. We're not trying to cure disease. We're not trying to build better electronics. We're just trying to understand how the world works. So to me, it's a very, very uplifting story. These are human beings who have really dedicated their lives to answering deep questions, and it's hard to think of a higher pursuit than that.
The Royal Society Young People's Book Prize celebrates the best books that communicate science to young people. The winner of the 2013 prize is Look Inside Space by Rob Lloyd and was announced at an award event here at the Society on the 11th of November. An adult panel selects a shortlist of six books, and the winner is then chosen by judging panels of young people from across the UK. We caught up with pupils from the Ellen Wilkinson School, who helped pick the winner and handed over the prize and cheque at the event.
Hello, my name is Ritu, and we are at the Royal Society Young People's Book Prize Award Ceremony with the Ellen Wilkinson School for Girls. We are now going to be talking about the books. Okay, so what was your favourite book and why?
My favourite book would be Don't Flush, because I was quite shocked at how much information there was about poo and wee.
How did the books help you with science at school?
The books kind of made science, I guess, seem more like interesting and more exciting, because with all the pictures they made it like bright and colourful, and it wasn't so just like sitting at a desk and just learning science. So it was like you could learn at your own pace and you could like see the pictures and stuff, which helped to explain it, so that was good for revision and stuff.
How do you feel to be presenting the prize here at the Royal Society?
I think it's such a privilege to be here at such an established institution like the Royal Society, especially awarding an award.
When you get old, what do you want to be?
I think I'd want to be a scientist, because what I'd do would be more practical and have a more of an effect on the real world.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Our Science. You can find out more about all the events we've mentioned today on our website. Visit royalsociety.org/events. And finally today, we ask Sarah Jane Blakemore, why science?
Science is the only way of discovering truth about how humans work and how the world works. And in terms of the personal question, why science? I find science really, really fun and intriguing, and that's why I do science.